Hey. Radio Tour, der Radsport-Talk auf meinsportpodcast.de.
Welcome to Radio Tour, der Radsport-Podcast, in what is a bit of a special episode, as we are doing our first interview, and we have gotten some very interesting guests for this first special in our series. We are speaking today to the Cyclists Alliance. I have two guests with me today. If you could maybe introduce yourselves at first. Who are you and what is your function in the Cyclists Alliance? Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm Dina Blacking. So I'm a cycling coach and a consultant in sport. And I've been involved with the Cyclists Alliance since 2020. Before I worked in sport, I actually worked as a lawyer. So I initially reached out to the Cyclists Alliance and helped them with some legal issues. But over time, I took on more responsibility for things like our annual survey, the mentor program. And now I support the organization with kind of overall day-to-day running as interim managing director.
So I'm Christine O'Connell. I'm the vice president of the board of the Cyclists Alliance, and I joined about a year ago. I have 20 years experience in strategy and corporate development in a few multinational companies and strategy consulting firms. I'm a keen amateur cyclist, and I care deeply about the Pro Peloton, and I've known about the TCA for many years, and when the job came up, I was just so excited to take part of it. So I'm here to bring, I suppose, more of a kind of business and a strategy and a governance perspective to the Alliance, and hopefully to help us build a more sustainable funding model, which we'll come on to.
Yeah, thank you. Now that we know what you do in the Cyclists Alliance, my understanding is the Cyclists Alliance represents riders on the one hand, but also helps them in other ways. So what exactly is it that you do as an organization?
Yeah, so the Cyclists Alliance is an independent organization that represents the interests of female cyclists. So it was started in 2017. When at the time there was no organization representing the needs and interests of female riders. And so it came about to do that. Obviously, as you know, in the last decade, female cycling has changed rapidly and lots of positive things have happened, including the introduction of Women's World Tour and the minimum wages that go with that. But we still focus on delivering impact where riders really need help. And so we focus very much on the professional pathway and looking at riders who still have lots of issues with welfare and basic working conditions. We might support them with legal advice. They might be on a mentor program with us. We might also do targeted advocacy on issues that are issues, but riders maybe don't feel comfortable speaking up about them. And we also provide data to the cycling ecosystem by carrying out an annual survey that surveys rider opinions and rider experiences. And that really has been one of our biggest contributions to women's cycling since we started in 2017.
So if I could just jump in right there, what are some of those most important issues that also the riders themselves tell you are facing them currently?
On our survey, they talk consistently about financial security. They talk about safety, you know, feeling safe, both racing and then also actually in the workplace. So, you know, we support riders with ethical complaints, and we've had cases that have successfully gone to the Ethics Commission and, you know, had people who are not appropriate to work in cycling removed or suspended or banned from the sport. Christine, what else is there?
Visibility. So broadcast coverage, especially for World Tour riders. I mean, you know, we still see races where they, you know, they show the last 40K and, you know, there's been an amazing breakaway and we've just missed it. And that's just not acceptable, right? So lots of riders looking for that that coverage. You know, it's a challenging one because it's a bit of a chicken and the egg, right? Broadcasters want to see interest in audiences, and the sponsors want the same thing. But right, who goes first, right? So who do you get on board first, the sponsors or the broadcasters? We're kind of stuck in that circle for the minute. But yeah, that is a big topic, probably one that we are challenged to influence, given the kind of large corporate interests involved in that issue.
Mm. Yeah,
but what we can do is we can get more visibility on the writers themselves, so by talking about them more, by featuring them more,
correct,
by, you know, interviewing more female racers on your podcast, to help them generate the same sort of kind of fan following that, like, the Poggies and the Van Aerts and the, you know, the millions of men in the Peloton have, that women deserve but don't quite have yet.
Yeah, and there's some really interesting research around how, especially women consume women's sport, that they're really interested in the athletes and their backstories, that's what gets them engaged. So the more that we can tell those stories, it doesn't have to be on linear broadcast, right? It can be, as Dina said, on social media, through podcasts. And I think when you get people engaged about the individuals, they watch the sport because they want to know what's happening. So I think that's where maybe there's a slight difference between the men's and the women's side of sport.
Yeah, that's actually something I was going to ask you about, because it is something I perceive as well. I'm not a woman watching women race, but I very much do enjoy watching female cycling. And also to go back to your point just a bit ago, it's a shame that you see so little of the races. But also, I think, in how you interact and see the female riders online is very much different, and seems to me also a bit more approachable than the big superstars in male cycling. Is that something you also observe, or is it just that female cycling is smaller and thus they don't seem so unapproachable?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's a bit of both, but I think I'm going to use a big stereotype here, but women are often more willing to reveal their vulnerabilities, and the way that they explain themselves, you know, potentially online, it just gives you a bit of sense of you're living that experience. I don't know the reaction that Kasia had when she had the crash of the weekend. I mean, she really felt the trauma that she went through, and it brings you closer to that person, that story, and you want to know what happened. So I think it is, you know, just in the way that women express themselves and how they compete, it's just a different dynamic. I personally find that very compelling. The race formats are different than men's. You know, we don't need to replicate the men's model. There's just the racing is fantastic, and it is exciting from start to finish, right? And that's when we miss that start, you know, just watch the last 40K, there's so much that's happened that we just don't know.
It also interrupts the broadcasts having to catch up with how did we get here, right? Is certainly part of it. The salaries are also part of it. What other things, or especially also talk about those things, what are the biggest structural gaps between men's and women's cycling?
Yeah, so I guess I would turn that question around, right? So I would say that we shouldn't talk about gaps. We should talk about differences, right? So, I mean, the biggest structural issue for women's cycling is to build a model that works for women, right? Not to say, how do we replicate the men's model for the women? The biggest issue that Dina alluded to earlier is the professional pathway, right? So the structure is going really well at the top. We built this amazing house with this, you know, all senior dancing, you know, roof, which looks fantastic. You have the Tour de France Femme avec Swift, which, I mean, the viewing figures in France last year were extraordinary, right? So that's an amazing race. You know, Paris-Roubaix, all these amazing races. So that structure at the top is fantastic. It's the next level down, right? We haven't really built the foundations. They're a bit fragile. So it's that Conti level. So that, you know, it's that pathway is how do you get to the World Tour? You know, we are unfortunately losing races. We are losing riders who are going too fast into the World Tour and then burning out, unfortunately. There are too many stories like that. So I think that's the biggest structural problem, is that we've built this amazing top-end structure, but we are forgetting about the foundations and in the middle. And if we don't fix that soon, we may find that in 5 years' time, we don't have a strong peloton coming through.
Yeah, and maybe just to add to that as well, even the kind of shiny top of the Women's World Tour has you know, it's far from perfect. So, for example, we had 15 licenses, but only 14 were used. If you talk to some of the sports directors in those World Tour teams, they will say that this year it is, you know, it's a stretch on resources that they've now been mandated to race pretty much the whole calendar. Obviously, that's what you want the highest level of racing to be. But I think maybe what has been missing is kind of an assessment of what's needed at this point in time and consultation with the people who are doing the hard work, like the people running the teams, the people driving the riders across countries for all these races. You know, it's a tough job. It's an amazing job, but if you put too much pressure on it too quickly, the sport won't be able to resist that pressure. And so we know that, even, you know, like I said, some of the World Tour teams, like, it is a struggle this year more than it has been in other years. And we don't want that to be the thing that defines how they experience the sport.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about the length of the calendar, right? And Dina has some great stats on the concentration of the number of races, you know, at this time of the year. You know, riders might keep burnt out, right? You get to the end of the year and there's not much time off, you know, and so that's a lot of strain. And we have obviously smaller teams than a lot of the men's teams. So people are, you know, the rules around, I think you can miss one race as a World Tour team this year. So that puts a lot of pressure on the system and on the riders.
So it's a bit of a blessing and a curse that women's cycling has grown so much in the last few years. So it isn't entirely positive for the riders. There are things that are being overlooked and that where maybe organizers as well should go more into a bit of a dialogue with the teams, with the riders themselves.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about, you know, going back to 2017, when there was no minimum wage, there was no maternity leave, there people were barely earning a living. You know, compared to that, we've grown by leaps and bounds. So I think we don't want to leave you the message that it's all negative. There's been some huge changes. You know, the fact that we have the tour back, we have Paris-Bay Femme, you know, all those things are positive. I think it's just about making sure the system is sustainable. So it's making sure that the top is, I know Dina's going to jump in and she's hitting as she could, if that top is actually, you know, is as strong as we want it to be, and then the rest of the house, that those foundations are solid. So that's where we're trying to get at.
I think this is where we would call strongly on the UCI to play its active role as the ultimate arbiter. Because you say about organisers, the vast majority of organisers don't earn that much money from putting on races. They do it, you know, I know a race organizer who basically earns nothing from her race organizing, but she's passionate, you know. So, you know, the sport relies on a lot of goodwill. There are people who make money in the sport, but a lot of them aren't organizers, and so they're not in charge of the whole calendar. The UCI is, and like actually the UCI is the perfect organization, you might say, to do a better job of bringing that together, coordinating it. And Christine mentioned the statistics. So I was just looking at this briefly. So the Women's World Tour has around 70 race days in 2026. 23 of them are in basically the month of May. So you have the Women's Vuelta in May, instead of, it could be in September, that would be much better, but it's in May. Then you have Itzulia, something else, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, and then you have the Giro. So you have this like extremely compact bunch of racing that, you know, will be hard for any team with lots of resources to manage, never mind, you know, World Tour teams who are, you know, doing well, but are definitely not at the level of men's World Tour. So, you know, if we could go back in time, I would say, hey, UCI, before you decide to mandate that everyone has to turn up at these races, can we look at the calendar? can we look at like how reasonable this is for everyone to do? Because yes, we do want an amazing calendar, but we also want to like set ourselves up for success. And, you know, if you're a rider who's not racing the Tour de France, you basically don't have much of a calendar after June.
So a bit of the problem is not only that there are so many races to race, but also the way they are spread out throughout the year.
100%. Yeah.
So is this
or not spread out?
Yeah, good point. But so is that something where you see a chance for you as the Cyclists Alliance to go into dialogue with the UCI, perhaps, and get them to change something about how things are structured throughout the year?
So the UCI has a consultation open at the moment. I'm not sure if you're aware. So it's basically asking for all main stakeholders to give their feedback on the future of women's and men's professional cycling, and it's very broad. It is very broad. It talks about the fact that cycling doesn't meet its economic potential. It asks for people to comment on everything from calendars and participation to safety at races to anti-doping. And so we will definitely be making a submission as an organization and also supporting riders to make a submission. And what we understand is that the UCI is keen to get as many responses as possible. And following the closing of that consultation, they will then start seeking to enter into dialogue or, I guess, running probably open forums. And we hope to be able to contribute to that. And in the most positive and productive way possible, we also understand that, you know, the UCI, sometimes, you know, it doesn't have 5 million staff members to organize the whole of cycling either. So, you know, we're not trying to shoot them down, but we're just trying to say, hey, look, they're in the right position. They are the people to organize this calendar and to help us make the sport better. So let's all work together to try and do that.
Yeah. And we should have said as well, we haven't mentioned, we have a rider council, which is really central to what we do. So we have, 12 to 14 riders. Yeah, a great mix of disciplines. So not just road, we have mountain bike, gravel, and maybe track. I might have made that up, but we have multi-disciplines. Multi-geographies as well. Yeah, Latin America, Africa, Europe, US. And they are really our voice of the rider. So they are the ones that are, you know, telling us what's happening on the ground, the races, what are they concerned about? So they are actively involved in this consultation response. And yeah, certainly when we ask them to rank the issues, the calendar, the length is one that comes up as a top wish and one that they're concerned about.
All right. Dina, you mentioned that the consultation also concerns things such as safety and anti-doping controls. Race safety, it has been one of the big issues over the last year, over the last months as well. I don't know if you were aware, I just saw earlier that apparently the investigation into Muriel Fuller's death at the UCI World Championship has been suspended. It's they are not going to investigate it any further. But that has been one of the big cases about race safety. What sort of work are you doing there? What do you see as the big issues?
Wow. Well, it's obviously a really important question. And we are delighted to see that as well, since the UCI and both CPA Women have kind of stepped up on this. It's becoming more of a continual dialogue. So we try and do what we can from a rider perspective and make sure that the rider voice is central in these conversations. So whether that's, for example, speaking up about the change to handlebars, which isn't quite the same as a mortality on a course, I know, but it's still, you know, this bigger piece of like, how do we make sure the rider's voice is central to the stuff that's happening? And actually, one thing that we have to say is that our riders on the Rider Council are extremely mature, and they highlight the fact that it's not about pointing fingers, it's about everyone taking responsibility. So, you know, we've also had conversations about rider behavior, and I know that kind of in the SAFER, so the UCI SAFER committee, some of their reports highlight that actually a lot of crashes come down to rider behavior too. So that's not without fault. But it's still, there's still lots of things that can be done around, you know, safe finishes, safe descents, using the extreme weather protocol when it should be done and doing it in a way that isn't indecisive. So we heard a lot of stories about how like, at Setmana Ciclista de Valenciana, it was very windy and they cancelled a day, but the process sounded difficult. And, you know, it sounded like, you know, I've myself have been a director at a race where the race was not safe. And yet the desire to continue the race was so strong that getting a sensible, objective agreement from all parties that we would cancel the race was very hard. And in fact, some teams wanted to go ahead and race and they turned up at the start the next day, but they shouldn't have raced. And luckily they didn't, but they might have. And so, you know, again, it's a topic that needs a huge amount of clarity, because when there isn't clarity, and it, you know, it can go really wrong, like you mentioned, Muriel.
Yeah, so there can be no gray areas where this indecisiveness can come into play. So there should be a way for everyone to agree on the same thing on safety. So that's
absolutely. I have to say one thing just to shout out. You asked what else. Forgive me if I don't pronounce his name right, but this Rondhaus, who runs the Simac Ladies Tour, he's an amazing organizer as someone who gets in touch, tries to get riders to help him recon the courses, really wants to make sure that the courses are appropriate, are safe, you know, are built with the reality of racing in mind. So, you know, the more organizers can do stuff like that as well, the better.
Right. To come to maybe a different aspect of the safety question, what are some of the biggest issues in women's cycling that the public should be more aware of? Are there things that are facing the women's pro peloton more so maybe even than the men? We spoke about the handlebars, where it seemed it was decided on a width for the handlebars without looking at how female riders how they look, how their physiologically, my God, now I'm messing up, but there were all these images of like these very, very petite women with their very, very small shoulders holding a 38 centimeter bar that was way wider than their shoulders, where they were asking, how am I going to safely ride a bike like this? So are there issues and problems that face the female pro peloton that maybe the public isn't aware of?
Well, I mean, I think it's you know, I sound like I say it again, but it's the pathway, right? So I think it's really easy to see the top and to watch the Tour de France film, you know, with Exist, the great that we have that back and the number of fans on the road. I've been out there the last couple of years. And I mean, last year you couldn't get anywhere near the road, which is fantastic. So just the amount of people that are watching the sport now and the inspiration that we're getting from young girls who actually can see them, their heroes, you know, on bikes. You know, that is extraordinary. So I think, you know, the public sees that, which is fantastic. What they don't see is the kind of the gap in the middle, right? So it's the races that are disappearing. I mean, there's a new rule that's being ununiformly enforced about Conti teams being able to race in the World Tour. So there's some exceptions. We won't go into all the details, but there's just fewer opportunities. And, you know, unfortunately, you need race days to actually train and to build that racecraft. And if we don't give these, you know, new riders that opportunity, they just won't get to the top. So I think people don't see that middle also because it's not broadcast either, right? So we're just seeing the World Tour races and seeing, you know, Demi Vollering and Kasia and everyone at that level. But you don't see is that we're just not having those riders come through and are having a good pathway and having the right resources in terms of specialist advice and training and nutrition and what have you, that pathway, you know, that you have in other sports that has a much better development path. We just don't have that in women's cycling today.
Right. Thank you. Maybe let's jump to a bit of a different aspect and get more into your work as the Cyclists Alliance. What are some of the challenges you face in your day-to-day work at the Cyclists Alliance?
So I guess I could highlight two. One is just focus. I mean, there is so much that we could do, right? And obviously, we started off looking at that World Tour level. And, you know, the team and the founding team did amazing work to get those protections put in place. But it is trying to pick which issues that A, that riders care about, but B, where we can have an impact, right? So, and that's where we've chosen to focus on the pathway and that lack of development side of things. It doesn't mean that we won't speak out about safety TV coverage or handlebars or what have you, but it means that our work is really trying to focus on where we're going to have that big impact. That's certainly one challenge. I suppose the second challenge is financial. We launched a GoFundMe last month, which is, doing really well. So thank you to anyone here who's listened. I'm really grateful for your support. The Cyclist Alliance was a volunteer organization for many years. So Iris and Carmen and Gracie gave their time for free. But as the demands grew, it just became unsustainable. So they took on sponsors and partners to help us build that organization out. Most of those partners came from the cycling industry. And as you know, it's gone through a bit of a challenging time, the cycling industry. And we've been looking at our own strategy and looking at our own funding model. And, I think the future for us is getting funding outside of cycling. So, whether that's consumer goods companies, technology, consulting, what have you. So for us, finding long-term partners who believe in equality for women's sports and believe in what we do, that's our challenge, is to get that done. That obviously is a long conversation, which is why we needed to buy some time for ourselves with that GoFundMe, which is done. I think we're on about 19,000 euros last time I checked. So that's doing really well. That's just individuals. That's fans who care about the sport rather. Maybe it's families whose daughters have benefited from our services. So that's done really well. So those are the two things, is focusing. We have a very small team to make sure that we do the right things to have the most impact. And secondly, building a sustainable funding model.
Is that maybe something that could also maybe not be the whole way to sustain your work, but also a viable add-on just to keep on being open for support from the cycling community? That even after this fundraiser and after maybe you found external sponsors, that people just support you because it's important work that you do?
Oh, please. Yeah. I mean, we're delighted, and you can join the TCA as a supporter, right? So we have membership for, UCI athletes and also supporters. And increasingly, Dino runs and others a great series of webinars on topics like concussion protocol, REDS, what else, heat climatization. And many of those are open to supporters as well. So you can also gain access to those great resources, as well as just show your support for women's cycling. So yes, please.
Is there anything you'd like to add to this, Dina?
No, actually, I think Christine gave a pretty complete response. I think one of the things that I think she did already kind of say this a bit, but it is like a lot of the work of the Cyclists Alliance, like this kind of work, you don't see it immediately. Like when you're trying to shift, you're trying to move mountains, basically. You're trying to change thinking, you're trying to change like regulations, like the stuff doesn't happen overnight. But eventually it will happen. And then 5 years later, you'll look back and go like, hey, we made that happen. But it is a kind of a constant, you have to kind of constantly just kind of keep nudging at the mountain to help it move. And so it's kind of like being a politician, you know, some of the best moves that you would make aren't immediately visible, but you have to get people to buy into your values and your mission, to trust in it, to then help it move forward.
I was just thinking that I think some good examples of that would be the introduction of minimum salaries and maternity rules.
Yes.
How has that had an effect? Is that something that is already making a noticeable difference in the peloton?
Absolutely. Like if you look back to the very first survey that the Cyclists Alliance did, the vast majority of riders didn't earn more than 10,000 euro. I was remember like somewhere in the 2010s listening to a podcast about the Giro and who had won the Giro and how essentially the prize money was enough to buy the team a round of pizzas afterwards. And so, 10 years later, we're looking at something completely different. And so it's undeniable, like, yeah, it has absolutely transformed the sport. It's made it possible. You've seen women like Lizzie Deignan go away, have a baby, come back, win Paris-Roubaix, like that, like stuff that you couldn't have imagined 10 years ago. And probably in 10 years' time, we might be having the same conversation where stuff again has happened that we couldn't have imagined, but it did. I mean, I hope that's the case. So yeah, like we definitely are seeing massive changes because of things like minimum salary, pushes for maternity rights, and just, you know, just general pushes towards professionalization. And like Christine said, not necessarily having to replicate what the men's side of the sport does, but just, you know, replicate the standards of any good business, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have a lot of legal cases, obviously, that we can't talk about because of the confidential nature of those matters. But those are significant in the lives we've changed in terms of people who have issues with their contracts, ethical violations, obviously whole teams going under, riders not being paid. So some of those are in the public domain, some aren't. So that's another case where we have a big impact that we can't always shout about because of the nature of it. You know, we have one lawyer on staff, and then we have a Morgan Sports Law, which is a UK-based sports law firm, which does some pro bono sport for us, which is fantastic. So we have amazing legal resources available to riders for very little amount of money. So that's something that we don't publicize enough. Because these are unique challenges that cross issues around, you know, regulation, often multiple jurisdictions, tough ethical cases. And that's where we do add a lot of value, which may not be, you know, known to someone until they need the services.
So it's a very good thing that it exists, even though it's something you hope you'll never need.
Correct.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and we see that, you know, back to the survey, you know, a lot of the issues that still exist that we find, the basic ethics issues or people not getting paid or not having their expenses reimbursed, that is happening less at the World Tour level, but at the next level down at the Conti level, there's definitely some inconsistencies and things that go wrong. You definitely would raise an eyebrow if you see some of the things that unfortunately still happen at that level of the sport.
If I could add, I think one thing that Christine has alluded to, but to say it explicitly, there's a huge power imbalance in any professional sport where you have an oversupply of really keen, eager people who want to make it as a professional athlete, and you have a limited amount of spots. And so there will be many cases where athletes, maybe they have sought our help or they want our help and they want us to speak up, but they do not want to speak up because they're afraid of being seen to speak up, of being seen to be a troublemaker, of being seen to be an athlete who is difficult. And so, you know, that's really one of the really important reasons why we need to exist. So we can talk about the stuff that's important and give riders the sensation that they have support and people see them and see their issues, but they don't have to stick their neck out themselves.
Yeah, they're often facing, you know, very complex issues. Imagine you've moved across the world at 19 years old. You left home. You are living in one country, racing for a team in another country. You have multiple complicated issues around, am I employed? Do I have health insurance? How do I manage my taxes? I mean, all those issues when you're 19 years old and you're suddenly in this very complicated world. And yeah, trying to support some of those women is challenging. But, you know, who else will do it, really?
Yeah, really, really important work that you do. And obviously, all these women are super, super young when they start out. That's the nature of professional sports. And so it's very good to have someone by your side to do all this. Maybe to move on into the realm of the a bit fantastical, you spoke about how a lot of what you do is doing small things every day, and then looking back 5 years later, you see what has changed. If you had the powers of maybe a magical fairy and you could change three things today and tomorrow they'd be different in women's cycling, what would they be?
So we have a vision for a fair, sustainable, and stable professional cyclo ecosystem where female cyclists can build long-term careers with economic, physical, and psychological security. So what I think that looks like is kind of what we've said in the last 30 minutes, which is firstly, as Christina's talked about a lot, a sustainable pathway with an economic model that supports those careers. And you can look at other sports that, you know, have models where they fund the development pathway through the money that they make through their top level league. So it's not impossible. It's possible. And the second one is rider welfare and safety. Even at the top level, every level, there will still always be unsafe experiences. And, you know, the less of those that there are, the better. So the more we continue to uphold everyone to higher standards, the better. And the third one, again, Christine mentioned it before, but we really need to turbocharge the visibility through better broadcast, better media coverage, better journalism, better championing of our female athletes. So it becomes like a spectator sport in its own right.
Yeah. And I'll add one thing, and it's a big topic, but it's sponsorship, right? So, you know, we operate in a sport with a very fragile and concentrated revenue model, which is the sponsor. And that makes it difficult to think about a longer term stable future, right? Look at other sports that have money from, from ticket sales or from broadcast rights or what have you. We don't have that in cycling. So, you know, unless that changes, we are stuck in this inherently unstable world of, do I have a sponsor for next year? And it's very hard to plan on a longer term basis and an investment basis if you don't have that secure revenue coming in. So that's, you know, obviously not unique to women in cycling, but I think you think about the next 5 to 10 years, I think unless we fix that model, we are never going to have this, you know, kind of really stable sport.
Right. That would have been my next question. Where do you see women's... It's like clockwork. Where do you see women's cycling in 5 to 10 years if development continues in the current direction?
I mean, I think it depends, right? I fear that if we don't, I'm going to keep saying it, if we don't fix the foundations of this house, you know, I'm not sure that we're going to have this kind of growth at the top can't go on forever. Until we fix everything beneath it. So I think it really depends. I think if we take this issue of the professional pathways seriously now, and we make sure that we are looking after those riders that are going to be the next winner of the tour in 5 years' time, then we will have an amazing trajectory into the future. But if we let it run as it is today, you know, we might just run out of steam in the next 5 years, which would be a great shame.
And I think if I'll just add to that as well, money doesn't mean professional. So I think we're seeing much more money in the sport, but we're still seeing like levels of disorganization or a lack of professionalism or certain standards that inhibit a team to really succeed, that inhibit a rider. Like something as basic as give your rider some form of a calendar. I appreciate that the rider, you might not know how they're going to perform in June. You might not want to guarantee them races in June, but the more you can give a rider a guaranteed program, the more they can train to it and then peak for it and then perform. And the more you give a rider technical skills as well as just taking them to races, the more you think about the rider in their complete sense and not just as a vehicle to winning a race, like the more you as a team, you as an organization, you as an ecosystem are going to get back from that rider. And I think we really need more emphasis across the board on, you know, recognizing that you need to invest in people, whether it's your staff, whether it's your riders, like even, you know, your bus drivers, like they're all people that contribute towards your mission of winning, and high performance needs everyone on the same page. So I really hope that we can kind of see less amateurism as we move forward in women's cycling.
Thank you. I think that is it on my part. Do you have anything to add? Is there anything you feel is important to add to all of this? If so, the stage is yours.
I think one thing, just to your listeners, start following more women in cycling. Be able to name like all the teams, be able to name all the women. Just try and watch more races, get involved, like be a part of women's cycling. Don't make it an other thing, an extra. Like it's an amazing sport, and you know, it's not predictable, which is why it's so exciting.
Yeah, and take the time to learn about the athletes. You know, they are very good about on social media telling you about their backstories and their history and why they cycle, and exposing, I think, a lot of their vulnerabilities and their joy in life. And I think that just makes it fascinating. So I think, yeah, invest the time in learning about the people as well as, you know, the person on the bike as well.
I think I'll just go ahead and agree with you. It's some of the best racing I have seen have been women's races. They are so impressive in what they do. And all I can say is thank you, both of you, for taking the time and talking to us about women's cycling and about your work at the Cyclists Alliance. And to all of our listeners, I can just say, go watch women's cycling, go support the Cyclists Alliance. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Er hat alles gewonnen, Meisterschaften, Pokale, die Champions League, und trotzdem, für viele bleibt Stefan Effenberg bis heute ein Feindbild. Ein Moment hat dafür gereicht. Dallas 1994, ein Mittelfinger und eine Karriere im DFB-Team, die ab da quasi vorbei war. Doch da beginnt sie eigentlich erst, die eigentliche Geschichte des Stefan Effenberg. Die Geschichte eines Spielers, der nie gefallen wollte, der nie zurückgerudert ist und der bereit war, alles zu verlieren, nur nicht sich selbst. Vom Tiger zum Cheffe beim FC Bayern, vom Ausgestoßenen zum Champions-League-Sieger. Das ist die Geschichte von Stefan Effenberg. Alles gewonnen, außer die Menschen. Ab sofort bei den 100 Fußballlegenden, überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Hey. Radio Tour, der Radsport-Talk auf meinsportpodcast.de.